This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks so much for tuning in this afternoon. Just a couple of decades ago, few of us had heard of sushi. Today, in communities across America, large and small, you'll find sushi. And there are schools here in the U.S. training sushi chefs. One such school is the California Sushi Academy. There, in the space of a few months, you can train to be a sushi chef. Journalist Trevor Corson spent a good deal of time at the academy as part of the research for his new book, The Zen of Fish, The Story of Sushi from Samurai to Supermarket. The book follows a student at the school, Kate Murray, as she tries to make the grade. The book also offers us a fascinating look at all things sushi. You'll find stories of the biology and natural history of sea creatures. You'll get a glimpse into the manufacture of miso, soy sauce, and rice vinegar. And among many other things, you'll learn that in Tokyo in the 19th century, sushi was cheap fast food. On the program today, with Trevor Corson's assistance, we'll take a closer look at sushi. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Trevor Corson. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Trevor Corson, who speaks Japanese fluently, lived in Japan for 3 years. He studied philosophy in China and worked on commercial fishing boats off the coast of Maine. His work has appeared in many publications, including the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the Atlantic Monthly. In addition to The Zen of Fish, Trevor Corson is the author of The Secret Life of Lobsters. The new book, The Zen of Fish, published by HarperCollins. You'll find more on the story of sushi and the book at www.zenoffish.com. Again, the phone numbers 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Trevor Corson, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Sure, my pleasure. Sushi, I think for a lot of us, when we hear that word, we're unfamiliar with it still, even though it's showing up in supermarkets around the country in big towns and little towns. We think still, I think, often of sushi as raw fish. Not so. What does the word actually refer to?
Yeah, right. That's what I always thought it meant, raw fish. And it turns out that sushi has a very surprising history. And the word sushi actually doesn't refer to fish at all. It has nothing to do with fish. We think the origins of the word go back to something describing a sour rice. And, in fact, what you get now with sushi and what really defines sushi is actually not the topping, not the type of fish or whatever that you put on top of it or inside the roll, but the rice itself. And it's rice that has been seasoned with vinegar, Japanese rice vinegar. And in this day and age, it's generally also seasoned with sugar and salt. And so it's a tart but also sweet rice. And it's basically sweet and sour rice, what sushi is. And so the word sushi actually refers to that rice. And everything that you put on top of it, doesn't matter how you make it or what you use, it's still all just sushi. And the origins of this go back to the beginning of sushi, where the rice played a very different function.
Yeah. Once upon a time, it was a nasty byproduct of a method of preserving the fish.
Yeah. I mean, it's very surprising. I had no idea of this when I started researching the book. But sushi, first of all, doesn't come from Japan and has nothing to do with fresh seafood. It probably originated, we guess, a couple thousand years ago, in what is now Indochina, inland, away from the ocean, probably in the area around what northern Thailand is now, and that general area. And there were rice farmers there who lived along the rivers, and during the flooding season, often what would happen was that fish from the rivers would swim into their rice paddies, and they would end up kind of raising these fish in their rice paddies along with the rice, and then when it was time to drain the patties, they'd have all these fish left over that they couldn't eat at once, so they wanted a way to preserve them. And they discovered that if you packed fish in cooked rice, the rice would decay, as you would imagine. You'd sort of pack it all together and bury it in a jar or something, and the rice would decay. But in that process, it created acids that protected the fish inside from decaying. So months later, you could dig this up, open it up. The rice would smell totally revolting, and you would wipe it off and throw it away. But that fish inside, even though it had fermented a bit, was still edible. And that's the origins of sushi. And basically, as it spread through the rest of Asia and over to Japan, people started to eat it sooner and sooner in the process before the rice had actually gone bad. So you would end up with a slightly fermented rice, which was kind of tart, a little bit acidic, and that's what defines the taste of sushi, is that tart, acidic rice.
Mm. How old is the word sushi?
Well, its origins in Japan are still a little sketchy, and we're not exactly sure when it came to Japan. You know, probably sometime 700 or 800 years ago, somewhere in there. And I have a little paragraph or two in the book on what we think might be the origins of the word. But su in Japanese means sour. So there's some thought that the su part of it is sour, and that chi comes from a Chinese word. So it's all a little murky. And it wasn't until a couple hundred years later, a few hundred years later, that sushi even began to approach the form we recognize today.
Yeah. We associate it so much with Japan, but as you mentioned, it was eaten in the old form of it was eaten across Asia. Is it eaten in these places today?
You can still get the original form of sushi in a few places that where the rice and the fish have been allowed to ferment for a while. You can get that in the area of Japan around Lake Biwa near the old capital, and probably in Taiwan and northern Thailand. So there are a few leftover remnants of that. But basically, it died out in most other places around Asia. Possibly it died out in China because the Mongols invaded, and they were big meat eaters, not big seafood eaters. But we're not sure. And what's happened now, however, is that, you know, Japan had a very widespread presence throughout Asia and World War II era, and sort of replanted a modern sushi in many places around Asia. And now, just as sort of the globalized version of sushi has taken over the U.S., it's also becoming incredibly popular in other places around Asia as a cosmopolitan modern meal, including in China, where it's really taking hold.
Hmm. This was a fascinating story that you tell in the book about the American occupation of Japan and how it affected the world of sushi. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, that was so surprising, was to learn that the sushi that we know today as sushi, basically, I mean, it almost didn't even come into existence at all. And what you're referring to is a very funny twist in the story, which is that the fact that we have the kind of sushi we have today at all, even in Japan, is partly thanks to the U.S. military occupation authorities who were in Japan after World War II. But this form of sushi, which consists basically of nigiri, which are the little packs of rice with a slice of fish on top, which you see at the sushi bar, and then rolls, where rolls are very popular in the U.S., not so much in Japan, but nigiri is really the main part of it in Japan. But this style of sushi is one form of sushi that originally existed in Japan, only in the city of Tokyo. And there were many other varieties all over the country in Japan. And you can still get many of those today. The original most popular form was sort of just a big bunch of rice pressed into a large box and fish fillets laid on top of it, and then it was all pressed down with stones and then cut into slices like a cake. And the Tokyo style that we know was very regional until after World War II, and it was, as you hinted at in your question, it was actually the American occupation authorities who were trying to restart the Japanese restaurant industry. They were trying to get the economy going again after the war. And all the food was rationed, so there was no way to have restaurants open and start serving food. except they realized that people could bring the ration of rice that they had at home and bring it to a sushi shop, and the sushi chefs could make that into sushi. So they came up with this system, and it worked pretty well in Tokyo, and so they just promulgated a regulation throughout the whole country of Japan saying, okay, well, this type of sushi is now official sushi, Tokyo-style sushi, and as a result, all of Japan suddenly switched over to this particular style of sushi, and the sushi restaurant industry was able to get restarted well ahead of other kinds of restaurants. So that explains the ubiquity of this particular form of sushi in Japan. And then, of course, that set the stage for it to spread around the world. And so it's thanks to General MacArthur and his troops that we have it.
Amazing. Trevor Corson is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. His latest book, The Zen of Fish, The Story of Sushi from Samurai to Supermarket. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener now, someone waiting to talk with us in Champaign on line one. Hi.
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 I'm a comment and then maybe a few questions. One is, I'm amazed at the variety of sushi in terms of, I don't know, just different flavors, different whatever. The other one is that, what about the raw, is that, what, let's say in the States here, what percent, you mentioned that it doesn't particularly, you know, have to be raw, but that's the only version that I'm familiar with. Is that the most popular one or not?
Great questions. The raw fish was actually a pretty recent development in sushi that, you know, was only really possible with the invention of refrigeration. And in fact, the typical traditional sushi chef's skill set originally was all about doing something to the fish to prepare it. And not just serving it raw. And generally, that usually involved pickling it in some form. And sushi shops in the old days in Japan used so much salt and vinegar in their preparations that they were actually known as tsukeba, which means pickling place in Japanese. And the reason is that, and I talk about the science of fish flesh in the book, and why raw fish is edible at all, and you know why it tastes certain ways, and it turns out that you really don't want to be eating perfectly fresh fish at all, because it actually doesn't taste like anything. Just like beef, fish need time to age to develop flavor. They just do it much more quickly than beef. So a traditional sushi chef was actually usually salting and pickling his fish or parboiling it slightly or using a variety of other techniques, marinating it slightly, to age the fish, to allow flavor to develop in the fish, but, you know, doing something to it that would prevent the fish from going bad. And so pickling was sort of the perfect thing to do. You could prevent, you know, bad bacteria from eating away at the fish, but you could allow the fish to age for a day or two and develop much more flavor. And to this day, there are actually sushi aficionados in Japan who say it's not sushi if the fish is completely raw, if the chef hasn't done something to it to make it to enhance it somehow. You know, so they're not necessarily cooking everything, but they are doing something to it. And a lot of that's been lost in this day and age of, you know, everything. The refrigeration and freezing technology is so good, it's just very easy to serve fresh, completely raw. But it's actually, in my experience, when you get a good, traditionally trained chef, it's much more interesting to eat fish that they have done something to. A great example is mackerel. Most sushi chefs to this day, if you order mackerel, they continue to use the old-fashioned pickling techniques, and it's very delicious.
Now, the final question, what accounts for the popularity, do you think? And I'll just sign off at this point.
Yeah, another great question. Yeah. I tell the story in my book, The Zen of Fish, of a particular Japanese chef in Los Angeles, and he runs this sushi school where the story takes place. And he's a very interesting character. He was one of the early chefs who first brought sushi to Los Angeles and started trying to popularize it with Hollywood types in that area in the 70s, late 70s and early 80s was when he was doing his work. And I tell his story, and it's really the story of how sushi came to America. And I think a few things are sort of things that we don't normally think about, but I think might help explain why sushi has become so popular. And I think one of them is just what I alluded to earlier with my mention of sweet and sour rice. Sushi is a very exotic-seeming meal. And so for those of us who feel adventurous, and particularly, you know, think of Hollywood in the 70s and 80s, I mean, a very adventurous group of people who would eat anything, if you want to be adventurous, sushi is really has a lot of cachet. However, the sushi rice, like I said, it's yummy. It's just sweet and sour rice. It's vinegar and sugar and salt. It's very delicious, and that sweetness factor we really like. And so I think while we were all getting points for, you know, trying this adventurous food, we were also eating something that tasted that was very easy to take, you know, flavor-wise for Americans. And the other part of the puzzle is that just around the same time that sushi arrived in America was also when we were all going through a great sort of health food awakening and realizing that we needed to eat, you know, less red meat and more fish and more grains. And so I think sushi was an instant health food hit as well. And people to this day still sort of give sushi an automatic health pass. And I try to complicate mm-hmm. that picture in my book a little bit because sushi isn't necessarily automatically as healthy as we think it is.
No, well, it's loaded with sodium and sugar to begin with and carbs.
Yeah, it was really discouraging. I went to a supermarket and I pulled a frozen pizza out of the case and a California roll, and they had exactly the same number of calories per serving.
Wow. Yeah, so think twice. Let's talk about this chef that you that is featured prominently in the book, Toshi Sugiura.
Right.
Did I get that?
Yes.
Halfway there. Okay. A pioneer of American sushi. Tell us about him.
What a fascinating character. Yeah. He it was very interesting because he arrived in the U.S. With actually no skills to make sushi at all. He had no idea what he was doing. But he was sort of a hippie, and he had left Japan and traveled around Europe and stuff. And he showed up in L.A. in the late 70s, and sushi was just becoming the hot new trend. And as I said, Hollywood celebrities were starting to embrace it. And, you know, once they started eating sushi, then everybody started eating sushi in L.A. And so he talked his way behind a sushi bar, and pretty soon he was making sushi for Olivia Newton-John and Neil Diamond and Barbara Streisand, and he didn't even know who these people were. He was just making sushi. And he would go teach himself by watching one of the master chefs nearby at another sushi bar, and then he would just go and use those same skills. And so he was sort of a maverick at the beginning. And what he had was this incredible charisma, and what made him unique and ended up making him one of LA's most popular sushi chefs for a long time was that, you know, the other sushi chefs were sort of more traditional, and they would have quiet shamisen music playing in the background in a very, you know, austere atmosphere, and Toshi's approach was completely different. He understood the American mentality and in those days in Hollywood especially, and he would put on blaring rock and roll music at his sushi bar, and he would shout and scream and drink with his customers and just created this wonderful boisterous atmosphere. But it wasn't just that he was sort of a party boy. It was sort of his stealth technique for convincing Americans to eat stuff that they wouldn't otherwise try. So he would pour them beer or sake and carouse with them, and then he would start serving them traditional pieces of sushi, you know, strange fish or weirder ingredients or things that Americans weren't used to. And he would, you know, yell and scream at them to try it, you know, try this. And the funny, and people would, and they loved it. And he was very popular. And he ended up really bucking tradition again when he opened the sushi school that you mentioned in the intro, which is where my book takes place, writing about these students studying at the sushi school, because he thought that Americans were just embracing sushi and that they needed to learn how to make it too. And so he's training Americans to become sushi chefs now. And it's wonderful. And this is the story in the book, is these Americans trying to learn to become sushi chefs. And I think it's great. And, you know, sushi has really become an American meal now as well as a Japanese one. And Toshi's story is partly the story of how that happened.
Yeah. I also mentioned Kate Murray in my introduction. What led her to enroll in the Academy?
Yeah, Kate is, she at the time, I did the research for the book in 2005, and at the time she was 20 years old, and she was from, you know, an Irish-Italian family. I mean, she had no knowledge of Asia, no experience cooking at all. And she didn't know what she wanted to do with her life, but she had fallen in love with sushi, as many of us do. And I showed up, you know, to start doing my research in this classroom, and I started watching this young woman, Kate, and she was just a disaster. I mean, she couldn't do anything right, you know, and I thought, oh, my God, she is never going to become a sushi chef. And she ended up becoming the main character in the book. You know, she had a hard time. She had a really hard time. But I decided to focus on her exactly because of that, because she was just an average American and had fallen in love with sushi. And she did, you know, I don't want to give away the ending of the book, but it's a happy ending. And she did get through this this grueling training program to become a sushi chef. And along the way, that was wonderful to follow her through her trials and tribulations for the story of the book, because along the way, you know, I could share with the reader all these little asides about all the things that Kate was trying to learn in class, and then you learn about all the fish and the different ingredients and the history of the meal and everything.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about her first days in class, and in particular when it first encounters those knives.
There was a funny, it was a point in Japanese history where the shogun, who had finally, unified the country, he wanted to put a stop to all this civil war, and so he outlawed samurais from carrying their big swords around anymore. So suddenly all the samurai sword makers in Japan needed a new line of work, and they started making kitchen knives. And to this day, Japanese kitchen knives are some of the best in the world, probably the best. You know, they're hand-forged. The best ones are hand-forged using these old-fashioned samurai sword techniques. And on the first day of class, you know, this Kate, you know, this clueless kid, basically, she comes into the classroom, and the biggest knife she's ever held in her life was a steak knife. And, you know, Toshi goes around the room handing out these big black cases, and she opens it up, and it's full of $600 worth of hand-forged Japanese, you know, samurai knives, basically. And she has to learn to handle these things, and she's terrified of them. And you're supposed to, you know, the first day of class, the instructor teaches them that they, as sushi chefs, you know, their knife is their greatest possession, and they share it with no one, and it, you know, it's imbued with a spirit and all this stuff, and you have to sharpen it by hand every day. And, you know, this is just, Kate had come to school imagining she was going to learn how to, you know, roll up rice with a bamboo mat, and, you know, and now suddenly she's got to deal with these samurai knives, and she has a really hard time with it, and you know, one of the things that goes through the story in the book is her trying to come to terms with these knives, because they terrify her.
Yeah. Well, tell us about the yanagi. My God.
Yeah, the yanagi, the word yanagi, in, you know, each knife has a special name in Japanese. And the yanagi is the main knife that a sushi chef uses. And it's called a yanagi because the word yanagi means willow leaf, you know, the leaf of a willow tree. And that's because basically of the way it's shaped. It's this long, tapered, you know, thin willow leaf-like blade and very sharp point on the end, like a stiletto practically, and it's about 10 inches long, and this is the thing that the chef has to, you know, has to become the chef's best friend. And she's trying to hold it, you know, at the very end of the handle so she, her fingers won't be near the blade. And, of course, that's the worst thing you can do. She needs to be holding it, you know, right up next to the blade so she can get control. And the whole technique, I mean, the whole way to hold the knife and the way the knife is designed and everything is completely different from Western knives. So this is very specialized knowledge. And sushi chefs, you know, we see them working behind the sushi bar, but we don't realize what they do all day, which is they spend almost all day, any good sushi chef spends all day back in the kitchen with his knives cutting up whole fish and, you know, gutting them and bleeding them and filleting them and breaking them down into the perfect little pieces that he can then use behind the sushi bar, you know, during dinner, making sushi. And so when you see a sushi chef, you know, making one quick slice with his knife and then making a piece of sushi at the sushi bar, that's sort of the exclamation point on a long sentence, you know, or paragraph even of work that began much earlier in the day. And, you know, all these other knives have all kinds of other specific purposes for dealing with fish. And you know, as Kate and her classmates are faced with each new kind of fish, each fish and piece of seafood is completely different, and they have to learn how to deal with each one. And so sushi chefs are also sort of these masters of anatomy. I mean, they're sort of curators of the ocean life, and the huge amount of knowledge that they have to have.
Yeah. Tell us about the flatfish.
Oh, yeah. Flatfish, which, you know, is sort of the general category that includes flounders and all that stuff. This is a funny aside. We think today that tuna is the pinnacle of sushi. But actually, surprisingly, tuna was considered virtually unfit for sushi traditionally in Japan. And flounder was one of the best fish, considered one of the kings of the sushi bar. Particularly the they're called adductor muscles that go around the edge of the flounder that help it swim. And, you know, there's just a little bit of that on each fish, and that is considered one of the highest delicacies of sushi in Japan. And most of us have never heard of it. And so preparing a flounder, not only sort of preparing it is incredibly complicated because of the way it's shaped, but then that gave me an opportunity in the book to do one of these little asides to talk about, you know, why are these fish flat in the first place, and why do they look so weird? You know, why do they look like Picasso paintings with two eyes on one side of their head? And that turns out to be this incredible story of how the young flounder fish actually starts out as a normal-looking fish, and then, like, suddenly over the course of 1 week, you know, it thinks, oh, I'm fine, I'm normal, I'm a normal fish. And then, you know, suddenly over 1 week, its whole body rotates over to one side, and it ends up looking like this complete freak and lying around on the bottom, you know, looking like a pile of sand after that. And there are all kinds of different flat fish with different grades of value, you know, within the world of sushi. And so all this stuff was just fascinating, and it was nice to be able to mix the wonderful kind of gee whiz, you know, facts about the biology of some of these creatures in with these classroom scenes where the students were having to learn how to scale and remove skin and gut and fillet and take care of all these different ingredients.
Yeah. For someone like Toshi, you know, someone like who's running a sushi bar or a restaurant, where does someone like that go to buy the fish?
Yeah, well, I would get up at 4 o'clock and go with the restaurant chefs to the fish market. And in Los Angeles, there is a Japanese-run fish market that's been there for decades now. There's a few now that in L.A. that supply sushi restaurants. And that was fascinating. You get there very early, and some of these places in L.A., they're located in the sort of Skid Row, near the Skid Row area, so it's a very, you know, sort of questionable neighborhood driving around at 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning. They have got inside just bins and bins and bins and tanks and just, you know, huge freezer rooms full of every imaginable piece of seafood you can think of. And it's very, you know, it's bustling and loud and noisy, and there's forklift trucks driving everywhere and water on the floor and bright lights and people shouting everywhere, and it's freezing. And, you know, mm-hmm. L.A., you know, it's 75 degrees outside, and it's like 45 degrees inside because they have to keep all these fish fresh. But, you know, as dramatic as that sounds, that is nothing compared to the central sushi fish market in Japan, in Tokyo, where I have also been, and I write about that in the book mm-hmm. as well. That place is just extraordinary. I mean, there is nothing like it on Earth. It covers 50 football fields of concrete, you know, wet, bloody concrete. And it is just this endless maze of little alleyways and it's almost like being inside a gigantic underground bunker. There's sort of bare, naked light bulbs hanging from the ceiling everywhere, and there are men shouting and screaming, and there are these go-kart trucks zooming around through all the alleys, you know, with huge fish on them, you know, 300 or 400 or 500 pound tuna fish, and there are men with table saws who are cutting into enormous fish, and there's, you know, live octopus everywhere. And you get there early enough, and you can go to the tuna auction, which is where they auction off, you know, the $20,000 and $30,000 fish for the day. Each of these fish is incredibly valuable, and of course, we've been hearing in the news lately about how a lot of these beautiful, majestic, big bluefin tuna fish are now becoming endangered mm-hmm. because of all of the fishing pressure on them, and that's partly due to the, you know, pressure from sushi.
Yeah, recently in the New York Times, there was an article with the headline, "Japan Adapts to Tuna Shortage. Waiter, there's deer in my sushi."
Yeah, right. Yeah, they were talking in that article about how sushi chefs are finding sometimes hard to get really good red meat tuna for their sushi bar. And so they're substituting other forms of red meat, deer, horse, whale. And I read that article with kind of a laugh because I've actually tried horse sashimi in Japan. I had some, and it actually is a traditional dish in certain regions. So it's not as if they're suddenly, you know, going, "Oh my gosh, we can't get tuna, we have to use horses." The word, this is a little interesting aside, the word sashimi, which is just raw meat, actually originally also didn't necessarily just mean fish. So the tradition of eating raw meat in Japan goes way back, totally independent of sushi. And so sashimi could have been raw boar, wild boar, or raw venison, or raw fish. And that tradition is totally independent. So it's become mixed now. And so, you know, I can, on the subject of horses, I can think of much better things to do with horses than eat
yeah.
them. But the thing that's just kind of silly about this whole thing of, oh, you know, we can't get tuna anymore, is, like I said before, tuna was never really considered one of the necessary fish for sushi at all. I mean, it was considered junk food. It was like garbage fish. No one would eat it unless they had to. And again, it was like those lighter fleshed fish and flounders and sea bream, snappers and mackerel. Those were considered the really good sushi fish. So, you know, it seems silly to me that I feel that the Japanese sushi chefs have sort of forgotten their own tradition, and they're, you know, they're running around trying to get horse and deer sushi when they have all these other wonderful fish that aren't as endangered as bluefin tuna, which we could all be enjoying.
Yeah. I didn't realize that yellowfin tuna were being farmed.
Well, there's a whole number of various farming and ranching operations that have been springing up. And with bluefin, often they will, if you look into it, you'll hear that a piece of tuna that you're eating is farmed bluefin tuna. But that actually, and this is separate from yellowfin, but bluefin farming tuna, that's actually not farming at all. It's ranching. And what they're doing is they're catching wild fish, you know, fish out in the wild, and then they're just putting them in pens and fattening them. So it sounds good, farmed tuna, oh, okay. But in fact, that's even worse for the tuna populations than just fishing the wild fish, is catching them when they're younger and then ranching them. And the technology to farm bluefin has just started to get going now, and you know, actually raising the fish from eggs. So that remains to be seen how that's going to play out. Yellowfin, we're lucky because yellowfin reproduce a lot faster than bluefin, and so it's there's less pressure on the yellowfin in the wild. On the other hand, they don't taste quite as good as bluefin tuna. They're not as interesting to eat. And then in the book, as I go through the various different fish, I try to give the reader, you know, this kind of information about the fish as in little asides as part of the story, so that we can all start, you know, making more informed choices about what we order at this sushi bar. And, you know, there's farming, aquaculture, and wild, and there are issues for all of these fish. I mean, salmon, tuna, you name it, that we should all be aware of.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Trevor Corson, his latest book, The Zen of Fish, The Story of Sushi from Samurai to Supermarket. My name is Celeste Quinn. We've got about 8-9 minutes left in this portion of the program. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, give us a phone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. One of the things that I found very interesting early in the book was the story of this of the miso factory. The recipe for an industrial-sized batch of miso includes, you know, first gather up 6,600 pounds of rice and 5,000 pounds of soybeans, and, you know, you put it all together and you inject it with some mold.
Right, mold. I know. And it turns out that mold plays a really important role in this whole story, which sounds sort of disgusting. And, you know, people are going to think, oh, I thought we got past that when we stopped eating the rotting rice and started using fresh rice. But this is very interesting. There's a particular kind of mold in Japan that is considered, you know, like it's worth its weight in gold. And, it's, you know, there are mold breeders who keep their mold, you know, in special caves and vaults because it's so valuable. And the reason is that mold contains all these digestive enzymes which break down and eat proteins and stuff. So when you mix mold, certain kinds of mold, I mean good kinds of mold, you know, not molds that kill you, but benign molds. When you mix these benign molds into things like rice or soybeans, what they do is they begin breaking down all the stuff inside the bean or the grain of rice or whatever into things that are much easier for human beings to digest. And as a result, you know, these are things that taste really yummy. So, for instance, miso, we all sit down and have our little bowl of miso soup and, you know, think, oh, well, that's interesting. But we don't realize where all that flavor comes from. It comes from taking soybeans and inoculating it with this mold and letting it sit around getting moldy for a number of months. And then you take this out, and when it's done, the molds have actually sort of died out, but the digestive enzymes have created all of these incredibly delicious flavor compounds from the soybeans. And this, in fact, is part of I talk about this whole thing in the book. It's very funny, the miso and the mold and everything. And then there are other components of this, flavor components that come from seaweed, flavor components that come from moldy fish. And scientists in Japan started studying this stuff back in the early 1900s, and they isolated what these yummy flavor compounds were that were produced in this way. And they figured out how to make them artificially to manufacture it, and that is called MSG. That's where MSG comes from. It's actually from Japan, not China. And MSG is essentially just a manufactured version of some of the delicious, naturally occurring taste that you get in miso soup, which come from breaking things down with mold. And soy sauce is, you know, of course, a big part of sushi. Soy sauce is basically just juice from miso making. It's made in exactly the same way, and it's got exactly all those same flavor compounds, and it's produced with mold.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener. Line 4, Indiana. Listener in Indiana, hi.
Hello, I've got a question. The fish, I know that, like, some of this, the salmon stuff, if you go, like, to a mediocre sushi restaurant, you know, it's not very good. But if you go to, you know, one of the more upscale ones, I guess it's like the best thing you've ever had. But is it all about the quality of the fish, or if they had, you know, a piece of the exact same fish with a good chef or and a not so good chef, would it taste the same, or is there something they can do to that? Why is it so much different, I guess?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think it's both. I mean, I think the best chefs are the ones who have the best connections and figure out how to get the best quality fish in the first place. And I often think that is worth paying for. I've become very picky in my sushi eating, not because, you know, I only want certain perfectly authentic this or that, but simply because I just think that if I'm going to go out and eat fish, I'm going to be willing to spend a little extra to have something that's really unique and really flavorful. To me, it's just not worth it to go out and have, you know, some sort of tuna that's been frozen for 6 months and gassed with carbon dioxide to make it look red, you know, and then to eat that and have it not taste like much. Because that's, in fact, where a lot of this fish is going through. A lot of it is now frozen for long periods. And the other thing that's, back to that question of farming, a lot of fish that have been farmed, particularly salmon's a good example, they don't have a lot of flavor because they just sit around like couch potatoes in their pens all day and they don't swim around much, which is what, you know, develops flavor in the mussels. They're very sort of rich and fatty, but they're not that flavorful. And then, you know, sushi chefs, I think good sushi chefs know how to take the flavors of a good piece of fish and then augment it even further. And they will do things like they will concoct their own special little sauces and stuff apart from soy sauce. They'll tell you, don't use soy sauce. Try my special little, you know, light flavored concoction sauce that I have made for this particular fish. So I think both of those issues are going to be in play.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. That gets me to the question I want to ask you to talk with us a little bit before we have to wrap up here about the proper way to eat sushi, about the proper sushi bar etiquette. One of the things that we learn early in the book is don't go nuts with the soy sauce, the wasabi, and the pickled ginger. But there's a lot more to eating sushi, and you devote an appendix to it in the book. You want to just give us a few tips?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's a very interesting topic with a lot of aspects to it, and, you know, we can't cover it all right now. On the website, www.zenoffish.com, I have a lot of stuff on that. On my sushi blog, I've got a recent piece I wrote in the New York Times about this very question. And I have a How to Eat Sushi page, which gets into all this stuff in great detail, and it's fascinating. And I'll just go over really quickly this habit we have here of putting lots of soy sauce and wasabi. Wasabi is the green, spicy stuff on our sushi. It actually, most sushi chefs are sort of chagrined by this because they realize that the flavors of fish are really quite delicate, and we put all this wasabi and soy sauce that tend to smother the flavor of the fish. And in Japan, they really don't go for a whole lot of that extra stuff. You know, we sort of assume that it's supposed to be spicy and very intense because I think that's sort of what we assume ethnic food is supposed to be. But a good sushi bar in Japan, they don't give you extra wasabi. And the good sushi chefs will say, no wasabi, no soy sauce. Don't even put soy sauce on this fish. I've just put a tiny little bit of my special, you know, flavoring on it already, or just try it plain so that you can really appreciate it. And so that's one tip. The other tip is don't feel that you have to use chopsticks to eat sushi at all, and it's better to use your fingers because that way the chef can pack the sushi more loosely for you. Sushi should really be very loose and should fall apart in your mouth. That's one of the pleasures of eating it. And a third thing, you mentioned the pickled ginger. The ginger is actually supposed to be kept separate from the sushi itself, and a slice between each piece of sushi helps you to cleanse your palate to appreciate the next different piece of fish you're going to get, because each fish, each type of fish has different flavors, different fat content, all that kind of thing. So the ginger, like in Western cuisine, you know, like a sorbet would be used to cleanse the palate between courses. That's what the function that ginger is there for as well. So those are some, you know, beginning tips. And it's not really a question of, oh, you know, this is the proper etiquette just so we can be officially, you know, Japanese and proper about it. It's really more about showing the chef that you know what you're doing and that you're going to really appreciate what he gives you. And not mask the flavors and not simplify at all. And once he sees you doing that, if you come back and again, and he realizes you're a serious sushi eater and you're serious about tasting the fish, and he's going to start giving you better sushi. That's how you get good sushi, is becoming a regular customer, developing a relationship with a chef, and then having him instruct you and educate you and give you new experiences and better ingredients.
Yeah. Well, isn't that true with so many things in life? The baker, the fishmonger, the butcher. If you develop a relationship with these folks, you are a much happier camper.
Yeah, you know, and I think we've lost that a lot with everything becoming standardized. And I think that the same things happen with sushi. We sit at tables and order off the menu, and we don't develop a relationship with a chef. So I really encourage people to try to break down the barrier across the sushi bar. And it's hard because a lot of chefs have sort of given up or, you know, they're not interested anymore. But I think if we go out and try to find a chef who has that attitude, it'll be great rewards for all of us.
Respectful curiosity, is that welcomed?
Absolutely, absolutely. Ask the sushi chef, is there to talk to you, even if he seems very stoic and stern. He should, and if he doesn't, go find one who does, and ask him everything. Ask him everything, and I think that usually brings a sushi chef out of his shell.
Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. A pleasure talking with you, Trevor.
It was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Trevor Corson is the author of The Zen of Fish, the story of sushi from samurai to supermarket. You'll find more on the story of sushi and the book at www.zenoffish.com. The publisher for The Zen of Fish, HarperCollins.